Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dirty Dealing, Grosso vs. Miramax, Waging War with Harvey Weinstein, and the Screenplay That Changed Hollywood, by Jeffrey Allen Grosso. Narrated by Jonathan Yen. The defining notion of any democracy is corruption. 19th-century Norwegian economist Hedvig V. Clapp. Introduction. The Buy-In. In Dirty Dealing, Grosso vs. Miramax, my story about waging war with Harvey Weinstein and writing the screenplay that changed Hollywood, you will find a 100% true story of lust, greed, betrayal, ambition, fame, power, corruption, deception, redemption, and poker. Further, you will be presented with the twisted tale of how disgraced former Miramax studio chief Harvey Weinstein, prior to his being ousted and exiled from polite society in spectacularly grotesque fashion, and while still at the height of his powers, stole my screenplay, The Shell Game, and turned it into the mildly famous and moderately acclaimed poker movie, Rounders. To put it simply, I believe that, without my Shell Game script, there never would have been a Rounders or any of the dozens of poker movies and shows that limped along in its wake. And if you'll give me half a chance, I promise that I can prove it to you well beyond any reasonable doubt. By the time all the facts are presented here, you will agree with me. Guaranteed. That is my oath to you. And that's just the beginning. What happened after Harvey Weinstein stole my script is actually far more amazing and unbelievable than him stealing it in the first place. Ostensibly, this is the true tale of a crime, a theft, to be more precise. A simple theft of a screenplay, or rather ideas, characters, settings, language, themes, and events contained in said screenplay, that turned out to not be so simple at all, and the shocking amount of chaos and consternation that said theft begat. The Sturm und Drang was indeed heard quite literally and loudly from coast to coast, particularly in the fancy offices, sprawling back lots, and hirsute hallways of Hollywood. This theft did not go gently into that good night. Oh, no, far from it. It became quite the big deal. In fact, if I may paraphrase Will Ferrell in Anchorman. At its heart, this is a story about corruption, of the mind, of the soul, of the courts, and of the system. Corruption of the kind that has seemingly run rampant all over our fair nation, now more than ever. Indeed, it seems like you can't turn around these days without being bombarded by an avalanche of criminal activity being perpetrated by the very same individuals and institutions that are alleged to be stalwart pillars of truth and integrity. Just tune into the daily news cycle at any given time, and you will be pummeled with wave after wave of stories about corrupt politicians, lawyers, doctors, companies, corporations, banks, financiers, and everything and everyone in between. It is literally everywhere. Upsetting as it may be, blatant, balls-out corruption seems to be the current coin of the realm. And corruption is what we will be exploring here in Dirty Dealing. Deep-rooted, ubiquitous, sinister, all-encompassing, unrelenting corruption. On the other side of the coin, Dirty Dealing is a story about perseverance, grit, determination, and luck. It is a story about poker and risk and all that implies. It's a story that isn't easy to define in a short sentence, and I don't mean that in a pompous way, but rather as a testament to my tendency to digress. It is part dark comedy, part light comedy, part courtroom drama, part cautionary tale, and part memoir. It is the story of a famous, or infamous, court battle waged against a dodgy New York City film company called Miramax that was known for helping to launch the independent film movement of the 1990s, with titles such as Pulp Fiction and Shakespeare in Love. Miramax happened to have been founded, and was helmed by, convicted serial sexual assaulter Harvey Weinstein, who is also at the heart of this case, a case that lasted for 10 long years, and, in the end, forever changed not only American copyright law, but also the way Hollywood itself does business. So how did this one, seemingly innocuous screenplay, one that was written in a little beach shack in Southern California by an unknown and unsung writer who was busy playing poker for a living and banging it out in his spare time, end up having such a colossal impact on the culture at large? Well, with a little bit of luck and a decent amount of old-fashioned elbow grease, that's just one of the questions that will be answered later. At the end of the day, after all is said and done, all I can say is that Dirty Dealing is a candid, honest, and 100% real and true story about what it means to dream and to pursue those dreams furiously and relentlessly to the very ends of the earth, no matter the cost. Chapter 1. The Deck. In the summer of 1995, I was living in Hermosa Beach, California, and playing poker for a living. But playing poker wasn't all I was doing in those days. Whenever I wasn't at the casino, I was sequestered in the front bedroom of a small, 2-bedroom, rented beach cottage that I shared with my roommate, Chopper, at 826 Manhattan Avenue, diligently writing a screenplay called The Shell Game. I remember playing the CD of Elton John's greatest hits over and over and over again the entire time I was writing it, as a sort of metronomic musical backdrop, the melodic repetition allowing me to entrance myself and stay focused on my task. Friends and random beach people would wander in and out of the shack at odd intervals and always ask why I was playing the same disc every time they entered. "Don't touch it," I'd yell from my workstation in the bedroom. "I need the groove." The story I aimed to tell was about a college student putting himself through school by playing poker, namely the specific game of Texas Hold'em. The protagonist, along with his mercurial running buddy, despite the objections of his disapproving, pretty blonde girlfriend, hangs out in the local poker clubs, plays a lot of Texas Hold'em, and eventually finds himself in hot water at the hands of a rather nasty loan shark and his crime boss employer. Now, if you are a poker player and or fond of poker movies, and this plot sounds strangely familiar to you, perhaps a bit like the 1998 Miramax release Rounders, starring Matt Damon and Ed Norton, then you are already up to speed. I myself had been, just a few years prior to writing the Shell Game screenplay, a college kid putting himself through school by playing Texas Hold'em. My real-life running buddy and poker partner, Munchie, did actually get into some pretty serious trouble with a casino-dwelling loan shark known as the Juice Man and his nefarious associates. This part of the story was true. It actually happened. I felt that these real-life events were colored with a certain gritty, authentic, salacious quality that would play well on screen. So I used fictionalized versions of them in my script. That's one of the facets of this whole fiasco that was always so difficult to accept. It wasn't just that I felt they'd stolen my story. I felt that they'd stolen my life. I didn't just write it. I lived it. In between beach volleyball games and trips to the casino for extended hold'em sessions to support myself, it took me about 6 months of serious hunkering down in that bedroom to write The Shell Game, and another few months to edit and refine it. By February of 1996, I was ready to send it out to the world. And send it out to the world, I did. I dutifully printed out a dozen hard copies, as was the time, and included a one-page synopsis of the story with each script. I wrote cover letters that were custom-tailored to each recipient and consulted the Writer's Market reference book in the local Hermosa Beach Public Library for prospective places to mail the packages. I sent Shell Game scripts and letters to production companies, networks, studios, and agencies, anywhere I thought I might find a friendly ear. Or I. Then I waited. And waited. There is a lot of waiting in show business, at least in my experience. A lot. So this wasn't unexpected. What was unexpected was that the story I had invented and the subsequent feature-length screenplay I had wrought from it would end up triggering such a far-reaching explosion of uproar and chaos. By the time the brutal melee had ground itself to an ignominious end, it would be responsible for derailing 10 long years of my life, which sent me spinning into a prolonged, rabid, frothing, self-destructive downward spiral. It would also end up incurring over $5 million in legal fees, turn my attorney into the California Lawyer of the Year, permanently change American copyright law, and the way Hollywood itself does business on a daily basis, ignite a global Texas Hold'em explosion, be covered extensively by every major media news outlet on the planet, including, but not limited to, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Associated Press, CBS, NBC, ABC, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, and NPR. Launch several major careers and make not myself, but many others, very, very rich. Chapter 2. The Deal. So, what are we talking about here anyway? Why did this particular court case garner so much attention and ignite such a prolonged media firestorm? Surely, this type of thing must be fairly commonplace. We live in a highly litigious society. There's certainly no shortage of lawyers and lawsuits in modern-day America. So what made this Grasso versus Miramax case so newsworthy? Well, it was mainly due to an ingenious application of an intellectual property argument that my lawyer instituted called breach of implied contract. Prior to my lawsuit, this particular approach didn't exist in these types of cases. Grasso versus Miramax was the first time it was used to any effect. And it worked. It worked like gangbusters. For a while. Let me back up for a second. What happened was, when I originally sued Miramax for stealing my Shell Game script and turning it into Rounders, the case was tossed right out of court. It was summarily dismissed without so much as a nod or a whimper, which I will expound upon further in a later chapter. This was a tremendous blow at the time, as you can imagine, but in reality it was just one of many crazy turns that this case took along its arduous and circuitous route. Nonetheless, we had lost, it seemed, right off the bat. "Sorry, Charlie, nice try. Go home," was the message. The case was immediately dismissed by the court as having no merit whatsoever. We were through, it seemed, just like that. However, as luck would have it, the battle didn't end there. Oh no, not even close. As it turned out, the fight was only just beginning. Once the case was dismissed by the first judges who reviewed it, and it seemed to be all over, hopes dashed, etc., Lo and behold, my bright shark of a lawyer, John Martyr, God bless him, worked himself up into some sort of three-piece suit state of satori and conjured up a bona fide breach of implied contract legal epiphany, which led to us appealing that initial dismissal. That's right. We didn't fold like a wimpy house of cards, so to speak, in the face of one bad ruling. We were made out of tougher stuff than that. We appealed the dismissal on these new breach of implied contract grounds that no one had ever heard of before, at least not in this type of case, and we won. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, Papa had a brand new bag. And this bag had teeth. We were successful in our appeal. The appellate court decided that in my particular case, there was an extra element present. This extra element, the breach of implied contract angle, gave us new life. Now, one thing you have to understand is that prior to my case, it was very difficult for writers in Hollywood and elsewhere to protect their ideas. As long as a studio, producer, network, or whomever didn't shoot your script exactly as it was written, word for word, you had virtually no recourse if they decided to steal your characters, settings, events, themes, and what have you. Before Grosso versus Miramax, you couldn't really sue someone for stealing your ideas. The thieves just got away with it scot-free. Ideas, astonishingly enough, had no protection of any kind, or very little. They could take pretty much whatever they wanted from a writer, no matter how long and hard that writer may have worked on the story, or how near and dear it was to their heart, and use it with no worries about repercussions of any kind. Seems crazy, I know, but that's how it was. The system was set up to favor the studios and those in power while keeping the struggling artist types right where they belonged. Struggling. My case changed all that. When my hotshot lawyer dropped his breach of implied contract bomb, there was a seismic shift in the dirty Hollywood landscape and in the law. What this really meant was that any time a writer offered a studio, production company, network, or other such entity a creative work, there was an implied contract present, so that if they used that writer's idea or ideas, the writer should be compensated. With such an implied contract automatically in place, simply because the meeting or phone call or script submission had taken place, failure to compensate the writer, should the writer's material be used to produce a commercial product, would be a breach of that contract. Sounds fair enough, right? Sure, to you and me, maybe. But in actuality, it was a highly controversial suggestion, and one that ruffled a lot of feathers. Well, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals evidently agreed with Martyr and allowed my case to go forward, overruling the original dismissal. This landmark ruling set a brand new precedent and actually changed American copyright law. I kid you not. You can look it up. Google it, as my Uncle Tricky used to say. It also caused my name to be freshly inscribed in all the law books, scared the hell out of a lot of entertainment executives, and generated a ton of press, as I mentioned earlier. Some of the articles that appeared lauded the decision as being a boon for writers, who now had more protection for their ideas, more recourse, and more power than ever before. Others took the exact opposite stance, saying that now it would be harder than ever for writers, screenwriters in particular, to get their projects in front of those with the ways and means to produce them. Which side was right? I honestly have no idea. Both seems to be the only answer, as both sides made valid points. No matter which side you agree with, I think we can all agree that I can't really sit here and talk about how much news the damn case generated without providing some evidence to back it up. That would be unprofessional and irresponsible, and we here at Dirty Dealing are certainly neither of those. On October 13, 2004, an article about the Grosso versus Miramax, Rounders, court case, appeared on the front page of the New York Times arts section. No joke. The fucking New York Times arts section. Front page. Heavy. Not only that, but the article just happened to be positioned in a vertical column that bordered a large photo of Bruce Springsteen, unrelated article, which I thought was pretty cool at the time, as I am a huge Boss fan. And although my article had no art, I'm not sure why, as I was more than ready for my close-up, but alas, sadly, no photographers ever showed up, I still got a kick out of bordering the Boss in print. "Look," I told anyone who'd listen, "I'm holding hands with Bruce in the New York Times." The article was written by Ann Thompson, with a headline that read, "Appeals Court Ruling May Shift Power to Writers," and it described how my lawsuit had just changed American copyright law. It also contained a very interesting quote, which went as follows. "How bizarre that Disney and Miramax would allow this matter to become a case," said Daniel H. Black of the Greenberg Traurig Law Firm. "In situations like this, historically, it's not worth going to a judge. You settle quietly." How bizarre indeed. Unless they knew that, in the end, they really had no chance of losing, and they didn't want to set an example of paying off claims. But let's not get into all of that right here. It's a little early. We will dive deeper into this matter in a later chapter as well. The Associated Press picked up the story. This article appeared on both MSNBC.com and ABC.com, and probably more places than those. It was titled, "$1 Million Ideas Often Stolen in Hollywood." It began as follows. "Pirates of the Caribbean, The Matrix, The Last Samurai, Broken Flowers, Amistad. Success isn't all that these films have in common. Each was also challenged by a lawsuit claiming idea theft, a common Hollywood problem that lawyers say is likely to continue as long as huge movie studios wield enormous power. It's like having your soul ripped out," says 37-year-old Cleveland resident Jeffrey Allen Grosso, who paid his way through film school by playing Texas Hold'em, wrote a screenplay about it, then sued Miramax over its poker movie Rounders. "All they would have had to do was give me a story-by credit," Grosso says. "They could have gotten me for nothing. I could have gone and used that credit to get other work. All I ever wanted to do was write movies." But why would movie studios, with every resource at their disposal, steal stories? Are these writers just cranks, frustrated wannabes with delusions of creativity? "No," says attorney John Martyr, who specialized in representing aggrieved writers, "many are victims of a system that favors studios and networks and offers little protection for writers and ideas. It's a small group of people that have all the juice, and if you're not in that crowd, you're really at their mercy," he says. "There's a real lack of moral compass on the issue in Hollywood, and there's an ego-driven arrogance about it, like, how dare you challenge this producer, this director, this studio? They'll spend $10 million fighting a case where the demand is $100,000. The Associated Press via MSNBC.com, November 9, 2006. That was a pretty good one, even if some of the facts were wrong. I didn't go to film school, but I liked what that Grosso cat had to say. Seems like he's really on the ball. And I liked Martyr's line about the lack of moral compass. Saying there's a lack of moral compass in Hollywood is like saying there was a lack of lifeboats on the Titanic. Just ask old Harvey Weinstein about that one. The Wednesday, March 3, 2006 issue of Daily Variety, which is basically the Hollywood Bible, featured an article about the case on the cover of the magazine. The fucking cover. I kid you not. And this one even had a photo, although, typically and tragically, it was a pic of Matt Damon, rather than the much more appealing and alluring Shell Game author. Shame. At any rate, it was written by Dave McNary and cleverly titled, Will Scribes Hold Cards? It started as follows. An upcoming trial in Los Angeles may give Hollywood screenwriters the upper hand in disputes over whether their ideas have been stolen. The case stems from Miramax's 1998 film Rounders and Jeff Grosso's suit alleging the mini-major ripped off his ideas about the world of underground poker from his 1995 script Shell Game. Key issue in the Grosso case, which goes to trial in July, is whether a contract is created when an executive hears a pitch or reads a screenplay, and there's the expectation that if the idea gets used, the writer will be paid. Grosso's case could be a landmark because it differs significantly from typical screenwriter suits alleging copyright infringement. Usually, writers who are convinced their work has been stolen face a more difficult task in proving copyright infringement by establishing that the film was taken from the script's actual plot, dialogue, settings, or characters. But Grosso achieved a key breakthrough in a 2004 federal court ruling. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals turned down Miramax's motion to dismiss Grosso's claim that it violated its implied contract with Grosso, even though a federal court had dismissed the suit's copyright infringement allegations. A contract sometimes may be implied, even in the absence of an express promise to pay, wrote Judge Mary M. Schroeder in the ruling for the three-judge panel. Ruling meant that Grosso could proceed in state court with his lawsuit alleging Miramax breached his implied contract. Not bad, right? And yet, even with all of the law-changing and news-making, during the long course of the Grosso versus Miramax case, things didn't always go our way, to put it mildly. First of all, the case never went to trial. It never made it into an actual courtroom with jurors and whatnot. All of the judges' decisions were made remotely, if you will. And there were some doozies, let me tell you. Not to give away too much too soon, but just as a little teaser, on September 12, 2006, The Hollywood Reporter published an article that contained what was, perhaps, the most maddening single line in all of the judges' rulings on this case. One of the most maddening, anyway, as there were several, as you will soon see. The article was titled, Implied Contract Claims, No Agreement, No Breach, and contained a highly revealing and incomprehensibly frustrating line. The court assumed, for purposes of the motion, that many of the same ideas were found in Grosso's script and Miramax's movie, and that they may have had a common host. Nevertheless, the court held that Grosso failed to raise a genuine issue of fact as to whether any agreement could be implied from the defendant's conduct. Hold the phone. What? A common host. The two works had a common host. Isn't that rich? Well, seeing as I wrote my script in 1995, 3 years before Rounders was released, I certainly didn't steal it from them. Ergo, to wit, therefore, I was the common host. Old Sasky, as I am sometimes known, host extraordinaire. What that statement meant was that both works, my Shell Game screenplay and their Rounders movie, could have derived from one singular place, namely, me. Can you freaking believe that one? to this day, it makes me want to put my head through a wall. But let's take a breath here before we get too excited. We'll wander into the phantasmagoric miasma of all this a little bit further on down the trail. This
sample complete. Ready to continue?